Welcome to Puro Politics, the political podcast of San Antonio Express News. My name is Gilbert Garcia, opinion writer and columnist, and I'm joined by
Metro editor Greg Jefferson.
Nancy Prayer Johnson, deputy editorial board editor.
And we're recording this on Monday, April 22nd, which is the first day of early voting for the May 4th election. We got Alamo College's board election. We've got five in NEISD, right? Mm-hmm. For anyone seeking guidance for those races, if you go to the opinion section on the Express News website, you'll get some help with that. We also have three appraisal district board elections. We're going to talk a little bit about those races because that's a new thing in Texas that's happening during this cycle. But I wanted to start by talking about some news on the Spurs, and we've been kind of following the it's been kind of this incremental sort of leaking of information about what the Spurs are up to.
And so we have a complete story. So
what's the latest on that?
So the latest is it's kind of in keeping with how this story has gone all along. So Madison Eisler, a business reporter I've worked with on past Spurs and Mission stories, she did an open records request with the city and with UTSA, seeking all communications between the Spurs, the city, and UTSA. The response she got was no.
Of course.
They see.
Nice try.
Yeah, exactly. They're appealing to the Texas Attorney General's office, which is they oversee open records, the process under state law. So they're appealing to the AG's office. I think Madison expected that. But they have to tell us why exactly they're seeking to withhold these documents, these records. And in doing so, sometimes they give away more information than they would care to. We got a response, or Madison got a response from the Spurs, basically saying, well, I mean, we're working on this big economic development project downtown.
What could it be?
Her open records request was tailored to the Hemisphere site, which is where we believe the city and the Spurs are looking as a potential location for a new arena. Anyway, so as weird as it seems, in trying to withhold records and keep this whole thing secret, which guess what? It's not a secret. We all know you're doing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
They, for the very first time, as far as I can tell, the Spurs acknowledge they're in talks with the city about a big economic development project, and we know it to be the arena. So this was the first confirmation.
Yeah. And as you said, I mean, there's been a lot of focus on the Hemisphere site.
Yeah.
We've learned that UTSA is going to be moving the Institute of Texan Cultures from the building there. That building is going to be raised. There's been a lot of speculation about that site. And I think the city now has an option to buy or lease the property. Is that right?
Buy. Yep.
Yeah. Things are all kind of coming together around that site. That seems to be the site that makes the most sense.
That's the site. I mean, to my thinking, and I've been busy. I'm an editor, so I don't have a lot of time for reporting. Madison has been doing great work on this, so I'm not as up to date on it as she is, but everything, you know, I've read and have heard makes me think. I mean, there's no question in my mind that it's the Hemisphere that they're thinking about for a new arena, which, by the way, is probably going to cost about $1 billion. That's kind of in keeping with all new NBA arenas over the last 10 years. But the question now is, you'll remember in the San Antonio Missions, our minor league baseball team, they've always been an afterthought in this. Mm-hmm. They, too, are looking for a downtown location. And there was, talk early on about creating a professional stadium, a sports district with two stadiums, you know, new basketball arena, new baseball arena.
Maybe sports and entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. To create a genuine district with those two, facilities as anchors, you get a lot of, you probably see a lot of restaurant, bar development, a lot of retail building around that in between them. That has, it's kind of fallen by the wayside, I think, because the Spurs are, they've got a little bit more running room. Their lease at the Frostbank Center doesn't expire till 2032. The missions, so they can take their time. And I think that's what they're doing with the city. The missions, they've got to move much more quickly because they're playing at Wolf Stadium on the far west side. It's an old stadium. It's pretty decrepit, and it doesn't meet Major League Baseball standards. So Major League Baseball oversees now the minor leagues, and they've said, look, you've got – I think it's – they've gotten an extension. They've got another year, and they may have an extension on top of that perhaps. But they've got just a couple of years to either bring Wolf Stadium up to code or find a new location. And there are like real questions about whether Wolf Stadium could be brought up to MLB standards.
So when you look at it, and of course we can't know for sure, but do you see the most likely option something downtown, or do you think it's possible that they may leave San Antonio altogether?
No. I think ultimately they'll probably settle on a downtown site. It's what site that's going to be is unclear. There's still Lodestar Brewery on around the Franklin, the Roosevelt neighborhood. I think there's also a possibility that you've got kind of this very large parking lot around Alamo Dome. I think I wouldn't be surprised if the city is at least talking with the missions about maybe a stadium there, perhaps. I mean, there's enough space for it. And if that's the case, you could get close to a sports district. I mean, you'd have to have some kind of connector because you've got a highway running between Hemisphere and the Alamo Dome. So you'd need some kind of connectivity. But I wouldn't rule it out. And, that's going to raise all kinds of questions about parking. Even the NBA arena alone at Hemisphere raises the question of what are you going to do for parking? I have to think that, there are going to be some new parking garages going up.
But there needs to be parking garages.
Yeah. I mean, my concern is that the city will pretend like we're actually a mass transit city. And it's like, you can just take a bus.
Figure it out.
Yeah. The subway or whatever. and not taking into, letting their aspirational thinking, get in the way of what's real and what's in front of us and not dealing with parking as they should. I think that's, something you got to watch out for.
Does this in any way, or would this in any way change the role of the Alamo Dome, which I think is primarily being used now as a UTSA football site and for events, it's been used for that for a long time. But, Will this change being so connected to a Spurs arena?
That's a great question. I don't know. I do know that if ultimately the Spurs leave Frostbank Center, it seems to me you do have a new competition for the Alamo Dome for the kind of second tier events.
Sure.
Right? Because you've taken the anchor tenant out of that county owned facility. Mm. The county's got to do something. I mean, they can't.
That's really the problem, the Frostbank Center, what to do with that.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, without the Spurs, I mean, you will have, the stock show and rodeo is not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And that probably opens up all kinds of, possibilities to expand the rodeo, kind of deepen the experience, do something cool with it. But what do you do the rest of the other 11 months of the year? I mean,
they just can't abandon it. It's already a bad enough situation. People are pretty bitter about it. I mean, when you think about the possibilities that can happen, it's exciting and it's, anything you can do to build downtown and the city is great, but they have to also take care of that.
Yeah.
Frostbank Center.
And you hear among city officials, it's like, look, we've got to make things right with the east side. Have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
But just abandoning the Frostbank Center to fate is probably not what they mean by we got to do something for the east side.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised. And like, I've got nobody telling me this, no sources or anything, but I wouldn't be surprised if as part of this, in order to kind of ease the burden on Bexar County, on county government, and on the east side, it's like maybe Spurs Sports and Entertainment, maybe they take over program, they're responsible for programming, bringing events into, the Frostbank Center. That's, that's in part what they do. So maybe, I mean, maybe that's a possibility.
Yeah. And we've talked about this before, and this is going to all happen way down the line, but I think we're probably going to have a serious political fight over how this is going to be funded.
Oh yeah.
And, because I mean, already we're seeing, we're seeing some progressive voices in the city saying, we're talking about using taxpayer money to build another arena for the Spurs.
Isn't that day done?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's extremely unlikely that the city and county, because I think it's going to have to be both the city and county contributing, are going to do it just on their own.
Yeah.
Like, the Spurs are going to have to step up in a big way.
And they probably know that. They probably have to be aware of the temperature.
Hopefully we have no idea. Like the Spurs have been, this is an organization that lives in the shadows.
That's true.
Like they are one of the most opaque, impenetrable organizations I've ever met.
Yeah.
Or have had to deal with. I mean, we've been reporting on this for nearly a year now. And like I said, this letter to the AG's office, this is the first time they've actually said the words out loud. Like, I mean, it's kind of galling did they believe that, you know, they could kind of work out this, you know, behind the scenes deal with the city and eventually bring in the county and nobody would notice, nobody would report on this. I mean, it's just kind of that's my thinking.
And it's this really interesting dichotomy, because if you look at the players, not just the current players, but I mean, this is, I think, historically been true that the players who represent the team have been very engaged with the community and have really been out there. I mean, going back to David Robbins and the current guys, Sohan and Vassell and Wimby, they're really involved with the community but the organization.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, there's a huge difference between player personalities and Pop. Everybody loves Pop. They're great at working the fan base. They're terrible about keeping the public informed about major decisions they're working on with the city and county.
Wanted to talk a bit about the abortion issue, which is going to be one of the big ones in this 2024 election cycle, and really since the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court Dobbs decision, which repealed the constitutional right to abortion, which had been in place since 1973 with Roe v. Wade. Since then, we've seen this factor in state votes, where there have been proposition votes where pro-choice activists have been successful. We've seen Democrats outperform expectations in the 22 midterms, and I think that the abortion issue had something to do with it. So Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, has been, I think, trying to figure out how's he going to handle this. 2 weeks ago, he put out a statement saying, because people wonder, there are people in the Republican Party who want to have a national abortion ban. Mm-hmm. As things stand, we have kind of a state by state patchwork, which existed before the Roe v. Wade decision in 73. So people were waiting to see what Trump's stance was going to be. And he said, well, this is the way it should be. It's up to the states. Every state, the states will do the right thing and everything. Well, the very next day, the Arizona Supreme Court made a decision which reaffirmed an Arizona state law passed when Arizona was a territory in 1864, which is a really extreme abortion ban. No exceptions for rape or incest. Only exception to protect the life of the pregnant woman. And Donald Trump immediately came out and said, Arizona has gone too far. The legislature has to remedy the situation immediately. This is a big problem. We saw Carrie Lake, who ran for governor 2 years ago, and was saying, we've got this great abortion law on the books. She was referring to this same one. She's come out against it now. Mm-hmm. So it's all very strange. And so I wanted to kind of look at the thing that really struck me is that the Texas abortion ban is almost identical. In both cases, you have no exceptions for rape or incest. It's a felony to assist or to attempt to assist someone in having an abortion. And Trump has not the Texas law was passed in 2020 when it was a trigger law, which went into effect after the Supreme Court decision of 2022. So it's been on the books in Texas for 3 years. It was triggered into effect 2 years ago. He's never said one word in opposition to it. But immediately with the Arizona law, he had something to say. And so, Nancy, I'm curious to get your take on this. And when you look at the obvious similarities between these two laws, but the very different politics that we see around these two states.
I kind of think, and maybe it's just simplistic thinking on it, but I kind of think it's because the presidential election is getting a little closer. Sure. So if he feels the pressure to speak on it and speak out about it. I also think, you know, in a lot of ways we're learning from Texas. I mean, he would never say it. but we're learning, you know, what's going on here after this went into effect about 2 years ago in June of 2022. I mean, there are women, carrying babies, right? That they know are dead, and having to give birth. There are women, getting turned away at emergency rooms. There are women having to move, you know, go other states, to get healthcare for this right that they should have. Doctors are scared to death. I mean, that is actually not something I came up with. It's something that came up in, to the Texas State Medical Board. There was a lawyer that said, you know, doctors are scared to death to do their job. Yeah. And so they take this oath, they, get the training, and they know better than anybody how these women's, their patients' lives are on the line when a baby dies, it starts affecting your own body, right? Absolutely. And so, they know how perilous it is to have these women just waiting to go through this natural birth process when the baby is already dead or are dying. Also, you have these babies that have abnormalities. So we're not talking about elective abortion here. We're talking about women who could die. Right. And there have been women die. And, you know, journalists all over the place, you know, local, state, national journalists have been telling these stories. So I think the fact that all of this is getting out, you're seeing the realities of it and abortion, you know, on abortion and not having that right. Then all of a sudden, Arizona is about to do this or doing the same thing that they're saying, oh, wait a minute. You know, now it's spreading. And we knew this was going to happen. Sure. Right. You know that the Republican states are going to join Texas and everybody's just in this fight to like, oh, who can have the most stringent law on the books? But it is pretty terrible. And when you look at the presidential election, I mean, I do hope that the women come out, Republican women come out, and vote with their hearts and to know and to really realize what's going on. Because no matter where you fall politically, this is still your body, and these are things that can still happen.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before. I mean, the Republican Party has the modern Republican Party defined itself as the party of personal freedom, individual liberty.
Absolutely.
And I think for a lot of women, and I know Republicans might see it differently.
Unless you're a woman.
Yeah, no. And a lot of Republicans will say, "Well, no, this is about the protecting life, and this is murder." Yeah. I understand how the issue is being defined, but for millions of women in this country, this is about individual liberty. It's about personal freedom.
You don't have to be pro-abortion to be, you know, you don't have to. I mean, who likes abortion? My gosh, like who likes that? But sometimes it is necessary. And I just think it is a decision women should be able to make with their doctor, between them and their, you know, partner, their doctor and their clergy, whoever their faith, and that's on them. That's a decision they're going to have to live with the rest of their life. But the government should not play a role in that.
Yeah, and I think Donald Trump obviously understands this. Like he understands the potency of this issue and the danger it poses to him now, which is why, and you made a great point in your column that it's like, look, he's got Texas locked down. I mean, like, does anybody seriously think Texas is in play for Donald Trump? No. Arizona is a completely different case. You know, current polling has him ahead by just a few points, but, you know, barely outside the margin of error. So, he's afraid.
Yeah.
And that it's very simple. I mean, you can dress up, how he talks about, you know, the laws in the two states, however you like, but he's okay not saying anything about Texas because he doesn't have to worry about Texas.
And that's right.
If he were to say something similar about the Texas law, you know, he's in danger of running afoul of the anti-abortion community in Texas.
And Greg Abbott, who's a big supporter of his.
Yeah, and why do that?
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have to. You could say, you know, a politician of principle would say how they feel about something, sure. you know, such a monumental thing. But no, I mean, it is still Donald Trump. Different case in Arizona entirely.
Yeah. I mean, he lost Arizona in 2020, although he will never admit that he did. Republicans lost big gubernatorial and U.S. Senate races in 2022 in Arizona. And I think a lot of it had to do with perceived extremism on the part of Republicans. And so this is a really dicey issue. And I think for him, it's always been, you know, he was declared himself pro-choice for many years. Mm-hmm. When he got into Republican politics, he flipped. But he's always kind of struggled with the language because I don't think there are many Republicans for whom this issue is just central to their belief system. And I don't think that's ever been true. When he was asked by Chris Matthews during the 2016 campaign, should there be punishment for women? And he said, and we've seen some Republicans since then kind of latch onto this idea that women should be punished. But at the time, that was really contrary to the Republican view of things. The thing was always like, we're blaming the doctors who performed it. We think that women are being coerced into it and women are the victims. I mean, that was kind of the political stance that was saying. And Trump said, he just kind of on the fly said, yeah, there has to be some punishment for women. And then he got all this pushback. So I think he's always struggled with the language of the anti-abortion, issue because he hasn't, it doesn't come really naturally to him. And so with Arizona,
it's hard. Like, how can you? It's so nuanced. There's so many things that can happen. And like, you know, even when we're writing about it, I'm like, okay, let's describe everything that can happen. You can't. And that's why the Texas Medical Board, they said, you know, we can't come up with a list of conditions to say, and under these conditions, and that means that a woman's life is at risk. They will not come up with a list because it's impossible to make that list the final say. Mm-hmm. And so in that same vein, it's really difficult to make the case.
Yeah. What I really hope, just for the sake of the American voter, is that we have a real discussion in the fall about, because there's a lot of stuff that we hear from Trump and others, some of his allies talking about late term abortions, women having abortions up till the moment of birth and even after.
And I mean, just the image of that is terrible.
And, you know, without getting too, you know, it's.
That is not happening.
It's being misrepresented. And I think Democrats have struggled. They tend to kind of not push back so much because I think it's a challenging issue for both parties. And I think the Democrats kind of don't want to get too into what the medical reality is.
Right.
And so, but I think that it has to happen because that is being depicted and it's really a false narrative, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Before we wrap things up, I want to talk about these appraisal district board elections that I mentioned at the beginning. And we had several propositions on the ballot in Texas in November. One of them, Proposition 4, it included property tax cuts. It raised the homestead exemptions for Texans from $40,000 to $100,000. And kind of snuck in there, I don't think many people really paid much attention to it, was something that allowed, it had something about four-year terms for people on the Bear Appraisal District boards. What this is translates to is that in counties with 75,000 or more people, which is 50 out of the 254 counties in Texas, they will have elections for three of eight seats on their appraisal district board. So it's, you know, it's not even the whole board, it's just three. Because eight was probably too difficult to do. I think we all come at political discussion from the idea that it's good to empower voters. It's good for people, for democracy to be at work and for people to have the right to choose, you know, public officials and for those officials to be accountable to voters. Mm-hmm. But there's some complications with this. As I said, it's only affecting the bigger counties, only three out of eight seats. Also, the appraisal district boards have no say when it comes to setting valuations for homes and properties. They have no role in appeals or disputes that people have over those valuations. Those are handled by appraisal review boards. And I think it's easy for people to be confused. And I was confused initially about this. Yeah. So the appraisal district boards have the power to fire or hire chief appraisers. They set the budgets for the appraisal districts. And so we're going to have this election. It's going to actually cost the appraisal districts to have these elections. But people, I don't think, are going to know a lot about these candidates or what they do.
Yeah, and they only have, like, the only real power they have is if they have an totally out of control chief appraiser.
Yeah.
Like, you know what?
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
100%. Oh, yeah. We're going to just drive up the valuations, which is, I mean, pretty rare. So, yeah.
Then
I mean,
it's only three anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Really? That's right. That's right. So their power is minimal. You know, is it a platform to talk about kind of the direction valuations are taking? Sure. I mean, in the same way that city council, I mean, because if you boil it down, the city council, that's their main job to oversee, to manage the city manager and to set the budget. But they do have, like, they can exercise power in a lot of ways that this board will not be able to. But maybe the power of the pulpit is something, you know.
It's not just this board. I mean, this is true for some other offices that people run for, where I think it's kind of, you know, I think it's tough for people when they run for judicial seats. Like, what is your campaign platform? What are you running on? Aside from the fact that I'm experienced and I know what I'm doing. I'm a good person.
What qualifies you for that position?
But in this case, really, what do you run on? You can't promise to bring people's appraisals down or anything, you know?
Yeah. I actually think it's going to lead to a lot. I know that Senator Betancourt had said, well, because they get so many questions is why he was quote in the Texas Tribune is saying they just get so many questions that this is going to be their way to, you know, have like a middleman, like be able to answer questions to the public. But I think people are going to be real confused. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're going to expect a lot more than is possible. And I don't think it's going to make communication better or streamline it. It's just going to confuse people. And when people go vote, they're going to be like, any, mini, miny, mo. I don't know who they're going to vote for here.
Yeah. And in Bexar County, I mean, we've been lucky. Like, we had Michael Amesquita as our chief appraiser for years. And, you know, he may not be the favorite among commercial property owners. Mm-hmm. You know, he's ruffled a lot of feathers over time. And I need to note, he retired recently, but his legacy, I think, kind of lives on in the organization. He was very good at communicating. Mm-hmm. And he was a good ambassador to property owners for what it was that the Bexar Appraisal District did and didn't do. He spent a lot of time in neighborhood association meetings and community meetings in just meeting individual property owners. And I don't know that three newbie board members are going to improve on that much, assuming that, you know, that culture at BAD continues.
Right.
So it seems a little bit beside the point.
One final thing on that is that, historically you've seen, in many counties in the state, board members being people who were elected officials who held some other kind of seat locally, and then they get appointed to the board. And obviously you can't hold two elective offices. So if you have someone who holds an elective seat in a community, they couldn't run for this. So it's kind of complicated things, and we're going to see how it plays out with this election that's coming up. I'm really curious to see how it plays out. But we're going to wrap things up there. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we're going to be back again next week. Take care.